listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to www.nakedbibleblog.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 40, our very first question and answer episode. I'm your residential layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how are you doing?
Pretty good. How are you again, Trey?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm excited for our first experimental Q&A episode.
Yeah, we'll just have to see how it goes, and you know, hopefully it'll encourage people to ask questions.
Absolutely. Well, do you just want to jump into? We've got a whopping four questions here. So,
yeah, go ahead and give me the questions.
Yeah, for the sake of time, we better go ahead and get right into it. So, question number one is referencing episode 37, and it's by Robert, and he wants you to go into detail about the meaning of Acts 2, verse 4, quote, "And they were all filled with the Holy Spirit." He wants to know who is the speaker referencing when it says, "And they were all filled." Could this be a reference to only the 12 apostles? Also, were they speaking in tongues? With when at the time of the giving of the Holy Spirit, everyone was inside, did they come outside and start preaching in tongues, etc.? So maybe you could elaborate for Robert on
that. Well, I mean, generally, a generalization would be being filled with the Spirit is sort of being both empowered, and I would also define it as being submitted to God's will. Now, in the context of Acts 2, I think the first of those is really more of what's in view. I don't see any exegetical justification for restricting the description there, the language, to just the 12. I mean, the 120 are first mentioned in Acts 1:15. And if you read that, that number included the 11 because they were meeting to replace Judas. And then they selected Judas's replacement from among the others there, the 120, using the criteria that we talked about in the previous episode in Acts 1, 21, and 22. And so Acts 1 ends with the 120 present in the scene, and of course the 12, the newly reconstituted 12, are among them. And then it jumps right into Acts 2. It says, "They were all together in one place." So that's all you get. You don't get any further indication of the 12 being singled out either by some descriptive language or any listing. And so I don't think we have any reason to suspect that it was only the 12 that are empowered with the Spirit, again, to speak these languages. So, and if you think about the logistics of it, I mean, you're going to need more than one person speaking a given language to really penetrate or infiltrate the masses at Pentecost. I mean, the result of it is 3,000 people embracing the message of Jesus as Messiah. And, you know, if you're going to, obviously that's going to be a fraction of the people that are there. And so how do you do that with only 12 people? I think the more logical reading, and certainly there's nothing in the text that violates this or impedes it, is that all of them were empowered by the Spirit to do this. So that's how I would address the first part of that. The whole thing about coming outside, if people aren't familiar with the text, let me just read the first few verses of Acts 2. It says, "When the day of Pentecost arrived, they were all together in one place, and suddenly there came from heaven a sound like a mighty rushing wind, and it filled the entire house where they were sitting, and divided tongues of fire appeared on them and rested on each of them," so on and so forth. And then it goes into the description of other people hearing them speak in their own language. So the assumption would have to be, I would think, that when the Spirit event happened, they would have gone outside. And again, this would have been the evidence of what the whole point of the Spirit's coming was, again, to impart the message of the Messiah to these various, you know, people groups that are mentioned there in Acts chapter 2. So there would be no need for them to be talking another language among each other because they're already believers. And so again, the implication is that they leave the house and then they go, you know, and start talking to people. You know, biblical scenes of events frequently do not give point by point or point to point detail. In fact, I think you'd be hard pressed to find one that really, really does. Even itineraries like for Old Testament Israel, if you compare, for instance, Numbers 33, which is the itinerary of going from Egypt, to Sinai and so on and so forth, there are differences between that itinerary and some of the other things you read in other parts of the Torah. And so a lot of these things, I think basically all such descriptions of events like this are selective. And I can only say personally, having written fiction, again, that's my only analogy for this, having written that sort of detail, again, he stood up, he turned left, he looked at the person, three feet from the door, that kind of level of detail is not necessary for creating or recreating an event or a scene. And so I think that's typically what we get throughout the Bible, not just the book of Acts. We get enough detail that the person reading or the person hearing, their brain can sort of mentally piece together the scene in what's happening. They have enough deal to picture what's going on. And so that would be the way I approach that question in Acts chapter 2, or those questions in Acts chapter 2.
Okay. Our second question is by Jacob. He would like to hear your thoughts on the identity of, in 2 Thessalonians, he who now restrains is mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
So he would like to know, is that the Holy Spirit, the church? Who is that?
Well, some, basically it depends on who you read. I mean, some people will say the Spirit, some people will say the church, usually to try to argue for some sort of rapturing thing. Michael is another candidate that you'll pick up, especially in academic literature, you'll see some reasonably decent defenses of Michael in that role. I don't think it's actually any of those things. I think it's something else. So we'll go with the something else option at the end of that question. I think the restrainer is God, and he's holding back final judgment, or in other words, the eschatological day of the Lord, so that the fullness of the Gentiles will be brought in. In other words, so that the final tally, as it were, of Yahweh's children, God's children from among the nations, are gathered, paving the way for the judgment of those nations in the day of the Lord. Because the day of the Lord, again, it's two-sided. It's a time of judgment for the wicked, and it's a time of vindication, for the righteous, that you did the wise thing by putting your faith in Yahweh and following him. So I think, again, it's God. He's holding back the judgment. Again, the final judgment, the final reclamation of the nations in judgment to usher in a global Eden where all the earth now belongs to God. So that's getting held back until, again, this fullness of the Gentiles comes in. Now, you'd ask, well, where in the world do you get that? Here's the hard part of the question for me. There's no way I can explain to you why I take that view unless, you do some of the research and the reading that I've done. Now, what I've asked Trey to do for the listeners is there's an article that goes through this view by a New Testament scholar named Roger Ouse. I don't know if he's still teaching or even living, but it's a really excellent article. It's on the restrainer, and specifically this point, how Paul in 2 Thessalonians 2 repurposes Isaiah 66, the language of Isaiah 66, throughout that chapter in both the Masoretic text and the Septuagint. And even there are examples that he brings out where Paul apparently read the Hebrew text and created his own Greek. In other words, he didn't quote the Septuagint. He did it on the fly in his letter to produce this view. So I believe 2 Thessalonians 2 is repurposing and interpreting as, in fulfillment language, Isaiah 66. Now, if you can read a good deal of Hebrew and Greek, you could read that article with great benefit and understand why Mike lands where he does. If you can't, then it's really not much help. But at least you know where I'm coming from and why. If not, being able to sort of track through all the details of how that works. Okay. I should add that this is a good example. I mean, oftentimes I get questions, and you hope it doesn't happen during like a live Q&A, but it occasionally happens where, in my case, it's usually somebody at church where someone will ask you a question, and I think to myself, I'd love to answer that question, but I need to explain these 10 other things to you first, you know, so that you'll be able to process my answer. And this sort of feels like that to me because it's complicated. And the reason I think the way I do is really because of sort of nuts and bolts, Greek and Hebrew minutiae stuff. And so it's very difficult for me to use an English Bible and walk people through why I think the way I do. But, you know, there are just situations like that where that's about all I can really tell people and hope that you know, they could follow through with it. But, you know, some questions are just like that. You know, this is one of them.
Sure, but just being able to steer somebody in a particular direction is useful enough. And I will post that link on the website. So just click on episode 40 and you should see the link in there. Okay, on this third question here, Mike, in episode 37, I kind of reference the dinosaurs, how I think, you know, in Genesis chapter 1, maybe that's where between 1 and 2, Adam and Eve is created and millions of years could have passed. And I kind of mentioned maybe that's where, you know, for me personally, my opinion, that's where the dinosaurs are. And John, one of our listeners, emailed me just basically a statement, but I'm going to throw it as a question towards you. He said that there may well be a reference to what may be called the dinosaurs in Scripture. Genesis 1:21 mentions creation of the, boy, you're going to have to help me on this Hebrew.
Yeah, you sent me that. The Tananim Gedolim.
There you go. Tananim Gedolim.
Gedolim.
There you go. So he, I don't, and so he was wondering,
big dragons, great dragons, that kind of thing.
Yep. In some places they're called great sea creatures. Ezekiel 29:3 refers to them as crocodiles, he says. True or false? Other places, apparently you refer to them as dragons, like you just said, or what? Could you maybe just a touch on that and elaborate?
Yeah. Yeah, this is actually a really complicated question. Just generally up front, I don't see any evidence in the Bible for dinosaurs. I don't see how biblical writers would have known about dinosaurs unless they ran across a skeleton or something like that. But again, how would they process that? They'd probably call it a dragon. I don't see any evidence for, you know, living dinosaurs during the biblical period or anything like that. So, you know, having said that, I don't think the biblical material really pertains to what we would think of as dinosaurs at all anyway. And here's why it gets really complicated. You have this term, tanin or taninim, you know, both of them can actually be plural endings in Semitic, but I don't want to digress into that. These things, these creatures, we'll just call them, are mentioned in connection with several themes in the Old Testament. Now, the question sort of situates one of them. Genesis 1:21 is obviously a creation theme. Now, before we even hit the language, we need to back up and think about Genesis 1. There are a number of scholars. It's not so prevalent now as it was, I don't know, a few decades ago. But because you have creation episodes, creation descriptions outside of Genesis 1 in the Bible that have God slaying a dragon or a sea monster, Psalm 74 is probably the best example here. Because you have those scenes, that sort of triggered a whole way of approaching all creation texts in Genesis at least one time. And the reason is this. If you look at Psalm 74, the notion was, look, here the God of Israel is slaying this great sea beast, and that's associated with creation language. It's also, as I'll point out in a few minutes, associated with Exodus language. But let's stick with creation now, this one category. Since God is slaying this beast, and that is associated with the act of creation, this is just like certain Babylonian creation stories. The biggest example would be Enuma Elish, where in the end, you know, Marduk slays, you know, a great sea dragon and chops the carcass, it splits it in half, and out of one half he makes the sea, and the other half makes the dry land. So the sky and the dry land. And so you've got, you know, this destruction of this beast, and out of that comes the heavens and the earth. And in the Babylonian story, Marduk, when he does this, brings order out of chaos because the sea dragon, the sea beast was just, you know, making life miserable or making creation impossible. And so Marduk wanted to make the earth habitable for humans. And so this beast has to be slain, and then the heavens and earth that humans will inhabit and experience are created thereby. So it's this story of bringing order out of chaos. And the Babylonian material uses, again, as a chaos symbol, a great sea beast. Now, the reason why you see that not only in Babylonian material, but also in lots of other material, is that the sea was otherworldly to an ancient Near Eastern person, really any ancient person. And it's because it isn't where people live. You can't live in the sea. You can't live in the sea. The sea is chaotic. It's untamable. It's wild. It's threatening. You'll die if you're not, you know, on a boat, you know, that kind of thing. It's unpredictable. The sea was an otherworldly place. And you'll actually get like Egyptian texts that talk about smaller bodies of water on the periphery of their boundaries. And the Egyptians will actually refer to bodies of water like the sea, which is the end, or, you know, they'll equate the sea with the afterlife or the netherworld, because it to them it spoke of unpredictability and death, and humans can't live there, that kind of thing. So it was just an otherworldly place. Now, when you're out on the sea in a boat and you see big animals in it, you know, whether they're whales or sharks or whatever it is, you tend to associate those things, these huge creatures that, again, don't live on land. They're not things you normally see, but they live in this otherworldly place. They lend themselves to, again, being portrayals, symbolic portrayals of that place. And that's why you have in the ancient Near East a lot of this kind of symbology, great sea creatures that represent chaos and death and disorder and all this kind of stuff. Well, Enuma Elish, the Babylonian story, again, since the supposition was that, and you get this in biblical literature, you get it in Mesopotamian literature, you get it in Egyptian literature, that before there was any land to inhabit for human habitation, there was just water. And so the primeval mound rises up out of the water, either at the command of the god or is created by the god from some pre-existing material. In this case, it's the carcass, at least half the carcass, of this great sea beast. So Marduk, you know, brings order out of chaos and creates dry land for human habitation. And of course, Marduk creates people too and all that kind of stuff. So since scholars were familiar with these stories, when they would look at a passage like Psalm 74, they thought, well, that, you know, that's really a good match, you know, for this whole idea. And then they'd go back to Genesis 1 and ask, well, is this stuff in Genesis 1? And what you get is you get really two things. You get Genesis 1:21, the reference to the Taninim, and you also get the word Tehom, which is in most English translations translated the deep. Now, Tehom, again, a few decades ago, this was accepted as a coherent argument. It's not so much now, and I'll explain why. But Tehom was thought to be the Hebrew equivalent of Tiamat, which was the name of the sea dragon in the Babylonian Enuma Elish story. And so the supposition was Tehom and Taninim. There's no battle going on in Genesis 1. And so what the writer of Genesis 1 is trying to convey is that when the God of Israel, who's the real creator, started doing his thing, these forces were already held in check. There was no need for a battle. They were submissive and bound. And so it was a theological polemic. It was a theological slant to how the Israelite, you know, viewed creation, that our God doesn't even need to have this fight. Now, of course, that doesn't work in Psalm 74. But again, this was the thinking. Now, nowadays, what you have is in Psalm 74, the reference to Leviathan there. And you also get Leviathan referred to in Psalm 74. Let me just go to the passage, find the passage here and read it for people. Psalm 74, beginning in verse 12, the psalmist says, "Yet God, my King, is from of old, working salvation in the midst of the earth. You divided the sea by your might. You broke the heads of the sea monsters, and there's our word tananim, on or in the waters. You crushed the heads of Leviathan. You gave him as food for the creatures of the wilderness. And that's odd. I thought we were in the sea. Now we're in the wilderness all of a sudden. Because in verse 14, it's going to transition to Exodus language, and then it's going to go back to creation language. You get to verse 16, we're establishing the heavenly lights and the sun, fixing the boundaries of the earth. Again, this is language right out of Genesis 1. So there's something going on there. But to get back to the point, people looked at this and thought, well, Leviathan, you know that? That doesn't look anything like Tahom. It doesn't look like anything like Tiamat. And, you know, what's going on here? Well, in 1929, the Ugaritic material was discovered, okay? Again, prior to that discovery, everything was sort of Babylonian-oriented when it came to Genesis, at least in the academic world. And, it took a little while for Ugaritic material to get translated and sort of become, you know, a scholarly focus. But the point is that nowadays, people look at Psalm 74 and they don't see the Babylonian story. They see the Ugaritic story. Because in the Ugaritic story, you have the same terms. You have Tanun or Tanuna. Again, it's the same thing as the Tanunim. And you also have Lotan or Liuyatan, which is the same thing as Leviathan in the Hebrew Bible. And that story, the Ugaritic story, is not about the creation of the world. It's about who is supreme in the divine council. And in the Babylonian story, you read through that the Baal cycle, Baal eventually emerges as the top dog, the vice regent, still under El's authority. But he becomes the chosen co-ruler among all the other gods. And he does so by destroying, defeating Litanu, winning this battle. And so since the terminology is so close, scholars looked at it and thought, well, you know, this is such a close match. It's got to be this instead of the Babylonian stuff. And then they took that back to Genesis 1 and said, you know, this is probably not, you know, aimed at the Babylonians. It's probably, again, a reference to, in this case, Canaanite religion, the Baal stuff, that again, Tahom. There's actually a Ugaritic word for that that means the recesses of the deep, just like our English translations of Tahom would have, you know, the deep. So that made sense. But it was also the place where, again, these sea creatures lived. And since the sea creatures, Tananim, is sort of used to as an equivalent to Leviathan in Psalm 74, the idea was that, hey, Genesis 1 is really describing Leviathan, you know, Litanu, already subdued by the God of Israel. And so the focus of the comparison changed in that respect. So that was a long way of explaining how an ancient Near Eastern person would look at this. They're not seeing dinosaurs like you and I would think of them. This is about chaos language and chaos symbology that is drawn from, you know, the otherworldly place known as the sea or the ocean. But the whole point of their stories is, again, things like who restrains chaos, who is the king of the gods. And so when the biblical writer starts taking this kind of material and swapping in Yahweh, the point is theological. It's not paleontological or biological. It's a slap in the face of what a Canaanite would believe. If you have an Ugaritic person or a Canaanite person happen to read or hear the biblical story of creation, they would get it instantly, that you're dissing Baal. You're dissing our God. You're saying your God's the real creator. You're saying your God's better. And the first 11 chapters of Genesis are just cluttered with that kind of thing. There is still a lot of Mesopotamian stuff. When my book Unseen Realm comes out, the whole Genesis 6 theme is cast against the Apkallu from Babylon, these semi-divine giant figures and all that kind of stuff. I mean, Genesis 1 through 11 takes swipes at just about everything in the religious world of the ancient Near East. And you even get Egyptian stuff. The whole idea of creation by the spoken word, it actually is a swipe at the Egyptian god Ptah. Because the Ptah's Memphite theology in Egyptian literature is the only other place in the ancient world, ancient Near Eastern world, ancient Mediterranean world, that describes creation by the spoken word, by the breath of the mouth. And so it's a very deliberate swipe at that point of that story, of that theology, that the biblical writer wants to make sure that they're hitting all the bases, is essentially that they're not going to leave any other rival claim of any other deity untouched. They're going to hit them all. And that's what they do in the Genesis story. So you have creation themes for these, you know, this dragon language or these the sea beast language. You have, again, what you'd have, what I guess I could describe as sort of theological polemic going on. But the third thing you have is you have historical enemies of the people of God. Pharaoh and Nebuchadnezzar are both described with this terminology, either Leviathan or Taninim, or, you know, something like that. In other words, they are painted with the same terminology again, because now the Pharaoh, the oppressing Pharaoh, and Nebuchadnezzar, we all know what he did. These are the prime enemies of the people of God. They are the embodied forces of chaos against God's people. And that's why this language is attributed to them. Can all of us think in the audience of a New Testament example where the great enemy of God is associated in some way with a dragon? Hello, the book of Revelation. Okay, you get and a lot of that draws on Isaiah 24 to 27, which is apocalyptic literature in Isaiah, that guess what? The day of the Lord comes and Leviathan is finally destroyed. I mean, there's sort of a network of ideas. This is a network of ideas that tracks through certain portions of the Old Testament and certain portions of the New Testament. And so if you're asking me, and of course you are, that is how I view all of this such language, because it's bigger than the Bible itself. You will find this sort of thing in religious texts, in mythologies across the ancient world. And I don't think coincidentally, they're drawn from sort of the same bag of tricks. It's the sea and the creatures in the sea, because again, that's just a horrifying, terrifying place. You are not safe when you're out on the sea. It's unpredictable, it's wild, it's untamed, it's chaotic. You could die real fast. And again, because of who they were, sort of a, you know, we can look at it and say it's kind of primitive thinking. Okay, well, so what if it is? But I mean, this is the way they thought about these things and the way they conveyed certain ideas. And so that's how I approach this sort of monster language in the Old Testament. And I think that's the way it needs to be approached, because it's consistent both within and outside the Bible.
So what you're saying is, in Revelations, it could be a T-Rex coming at us, right?
No, I don't think we're going to see a real T-Rex.
Okay, because that's much more scarier to me. I see a T-Rex coming. It's got seven heads. You know, I don't know.
Well, I'd take that, something you could actually probably take down with a good sized bomb, as opposed to something that's satanic. You know,
Jurassic Park's got a whole new meaning to me. If I'm watching it, I'm like, no. I appreciate you going into detail with all that. That information is fascinating, and I don't think too many people spend a whole lot of time, you know, explaining that, or even have the ability to explain that to people like, you know, lay people like me.
So. Well, I think it's really cool, because the language gets picked up, you know, in the Second Temple period. This is where you get, you know, it gets tied to all sorts of things. You know, the Ouroboros, you know, the serpent with the, you know, its tail in its mouth, and you get into rabbinic literature, and you get Leviathan and Behemoth imagery in that sort of literature. Again, really doing the same thing. You know, the enemies of God get portrayed by these things. That you get in certain texts, this is kind of interesting, but in certain texts, when Leviathan or the beast, you know, and there, look at the terminology in Revelation, the beast, okay, that comes from the sea. What a surprise. And of course, at the end of Revelation, there is no more sea. This is why chaos is done with. There is no more disorder. But you get imagery of this great, like, divine banquet, you know, the marriage supper of the Lamb is the way the New Testament has it. Well, there's Jewish rabbinic stuff that have, you know, sort of the end of, you know, when the day of the Lord comes, there's this divine banquet. And you'll get some texts that guess what's served at dinner? It's Leviathan. You I mean, again, it's this imagery of it's done now. This beast is finally dead, like really dead. And it's never going to come back again. We'll never have to worry about this again because now we're in a perfect place. We're in the new Eden. There is no threat of this anymore. So it actually works itself out, you know, into texts, Jewish and Christian, outside the Bible in some real interesting ways.
We'll just use its leftovers for oil.
Yeah, there you go.
Boom. Okay, well, great. I appreciate that. All right, so our next question's from me. Kind of episode 36, we're talking about the 12 apostles. I have a fascination, and I wanted to get your opinion on it. That, you know, I'm curious, why 12 apostles? I mean, all the numbers in the Bible, are they divine? Isaac Newton, who I'm a big fan of, he dedicated his life work with the Bible in mind. And so I'm curious, what's your opinion about any numbers, the dimensions, tabernacle, all these things have specific numbers associated with them. Are those particular numbers divine in nature?
Well, I think it would depend on what you mean by the question. I don't think math was invented by God. I don't think numbers are, you know, have some sort of,
no,
you know,
he had a particular
spiritual life or something like that. I wouldn't use the word divine. I would say that the order that math helps us see and understand, in other words, the elegance or the symmetry of creation, of nature, of life as it runs, you know, all the stuff that math applies to, which is frankly just about everything. All of that stuff, math is a human invention. There are different mathematical schemes, but they all bring into view design. And I do think design is part of creation. So ultimately, numbers and math take us back to a creator through the root of the order and the symmetry that they help us discern and understand. So that's the way I would approach it. I think it might just be a language difference there. But like specific numbers in scripture, mm-hmm. I do think some of them are there for more than just counting. I mean, you brought up the number 12 specifically. And again, while we do have the 12, which is the tribes of Israel, which is the apostles, and then you put them together and you get the 24 elders and all that kind of stuff. I mean, well, while I think there is certainly something to that, I also think that, you know, this might freak some people out unless they've read fairly deeply into some of the stuff I've done, or if they read The Portent, let's put it that way. But I think there are certain numbers like 12 that have to do also with the zodiac, what I would call astral theology. And I don't mean astrology like Miss Cleo, you know, like who am I going to marry, how much money am I going to make, and all that kind of nonsense. The assumption in the ancient world among Jews, this is why you find zodiac mosaics in Jewish synagogues. Well, were they apostates? Well, no, they're not. But their belief was that, hey, we read Genesis, and it says that God made the stars and he made the heavenly celestial objects, and they're for times and seasons. And this is language right out of Genesis. So they're put there by God, and God's in control of them. And we can look up at the sky ourselves and we can see patterns. And so maybe, just maybe, if we really sort of watch that long enough, maybe we could figure out that God is either trying to communicate what he's doing, or we could sort of somehow understand that he's up to something. And you get this in Psalm 19, and specifically Paul's use of Psalm 19. Again, for people who've read The Portent, this is not going to be unfamiliar. But if you go to Romans 10, this is Paul's discussion. Well, I'll go back to verse 14. Paul is talking about, you know, the Jews and the Gentiles and all this stuff and the Messiah. And he says in verse 14, how then will they call on him in whom they have not believed? And how are they to believe in him of whom they have never heard? And how are they to hear without someone preaching? How are they to preach unless they're sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the good news. But they have not all obeyed the gospel. For Isaiah says, Lord, who has believed what he has heard from us? So faith comes from hearing, and hearing through the word of God. But I ask, Paul says, have they not heard? Indeed they have, For their voice, Harry starts quoting Psalm 19. For their voice has gone out to all the earth, and their words to the ends of the world. Now, if you go back in Psalm 19, there's a text critical issue in Psalm 19. It either says, it's talking about the sun, moon, and stars, you know, all that kind of stuff in Psalm 19. And it says, either their voice has gone out to all the earth, that's the Septuagint, that's what Paul quotes. In other words, somehow they believed that the stars could speak, they could message something. And Paul's actually saying, he's actually connecting that idea to the gospel, or at least to Christ. The Masoretic text says, their line has gone out to all the earth. And that's a reference to the ecliptic, of course, which is the path that the constellations follow, the constellations of the zodiac. So I use that for an illustration to say that there was this idea that God could communicate things through the heavens. Again, this isn't astrology as we think of it, because it's you know, scholars refer to it as astral theology or astral prophecy. It's a known genre much later in the Greco-Roman world. And a lot of people, I shouldn't say a lot of people, some people think that Revelation is largely an astral theological book. And I think there's something to that. I wouldn't go as far as some others. And I don't think that Paul is saying that you could look at the constellations and sort of get the Romans road out of it. What I think Paul is actually alluding to here is what we read in Revelation 12. Now, I can't prove that, but that's my suspicion. I think that the tradition we have preserved in Revelation 12 about, and I actually take when John says I looked up at the heavens and saw, I think he's serious. I think John is reporting in Revelation 12 what the Magi saw in the sky at the time of the Messiah's birth. And I think Paul picks up on that. And so the point is that people could have known that a divine king had arrived. And it just so happened that if you do the math, here we are back to math, if you do the math, you can arrive at a specific date that I think, again, not coincidentally, coincides with Rosh Hashanah, which is the day of the inauguration of every new Israelite king. And it also coincides with Jewish tradition about Noah and the timing of the flood. And we all, you know, we go back to Genesis 6 and let's have a party there. I mean, there's all these things, again, that are converging in the birth of the Messiah. Now, I don't do much of that in my upcoming book, Unseen Realm. That this is stuff for book two. Yeah, again, for the audience, I'm not lying when I say I have a whole other book just sort of waiting to get written. The myth book, I know, is packed with a lot of stuff, but that is the first installment. There's a lot that is left over. And I do a little bit of this in The Portent. Again, I fictionalize some of this content in The Portent as well. But those are sort of all teasers or all sort of, you know, dropping this and that. To get back to the question, I think that some numbers in Scripture do telegraph these sorts of ideas. And this is a little bit beyond your normal gematria. If you're familiar with gematria, that's when you, certain languages, the letters of the alphabet corresponded to numbers. Greek does that, Hebrew does that, Aramaic did it. You know, not every language does, but a lot of them did. And so there are places, 666 is the best example, where, you know, he gives you the numbers, so you're not supposed to guess at the number. You're supposed to guess at what the number means, and it's a human number. Well, no kidding, you know. But that's actually a hint as to how to think about it. It's gematria. That number means something, and not only does it mean something in terms of the letters that the numbers form, but that has to be framed within a certain wider context, which is what a lot of people don't do when they interpret 666 and other things in Revelation. The dove, when Jesus is baptized, you know, the Spirit descends on him, you know, like a dove. Well, there is no Old Testament passage that has that sort of imagery. You go back to Genesis 1, the hovering, it's not a dove there. We actually don't have a bird named, you know. But if you take the Greek word for dove and put it into, you know, put it through the gematria mill, the sum total of those letters is, again, I don't think coincidentally, the same sum total as the letters Alpha and Omega. Again, I just don't think that's accidental. There's another one in John I don't want to bring up, with 153 fish, because I use that in the portent. That would be a plot spoiler. But there are just things like this going on that transcend the text. And I do think there is a biblical numerology. I think a lot of what you'd pick up and read sort of is too imaginative. It just sort of takes the ball and runs with it all over the place. The way I think it should be approached is, can you situate what you think is going on here? Does it have exegetical foundation? And the thing I just gave you in Romans 10 does, because Paul is quoting Psalm 19. Okay, does it have exegetical foundation? And does it make sense within the wider ancient Near Eastern, ancient Mediterranean culture of the time? If you can situate, you know, what you think you see in those two ways, then I think you might be on to something. So certain numbers do have, you know, that sort of appeal. The number 40, I think, is artificial. And what I mean by that is, if you actually concord that, it's like everything in the Old Testament happens in 40s. Again, that is a little too coincidental for me. I think the point there is either a generational thing, or it's a literary way that people back then would have understood as completing a generation or completing a reign or something like that. There's this completion aspect to it because it just shows up everywhere. You know, it has its own sort of broad associations because of where it's used. So some numbers, I think, certainly have, I guess I could say, divine telegraphing, because, again, under inspiration, they're being used to telegraph certain ideas. But in and of themselves, you know, numbers, I don't think there's any divine quality about math or about numbers. I think it just depends on their usage.
Interesting. Fascinating subject for me.
It's really cool stuff. And again, some of this will be, you know, Lord willing, if there's a book after Unseen Realm, then some of it will be into that, because I do find it really interesting. And certainly future fiction installments, it's something that I'm going to dip into again, because it's quite fascinating. And because, again, 666, my mind just goes back to, because if you're just doing gematria with 666, and, you know, we've all read this stuff. Oh, it was Henry Kissinger. Oh, it was this president. Oh, it was that guy. Oh, it's Nero. Oh, it's – if that's all you're doing, you're just scratching the surface. There are things that you are not thinking about and probably aren't even aware of that you need to be thinking about, that will help you make sense of that, maybe for a different reason. But I don't want to get too far into that, because there's a number of directions it could take. And again, I'm not gonna pretend I'm a prophet. I'm not a prophet. But there are things that I could see as possibilities there that I've not seen in print. Let's just put it that way. There are one or two that you could find in what I like to refer to as the fugitive literature. You know, again, this academic stuff that maybe 10 scholars in the world will ever find that article and read it, which is unfortunate. But there are just things going on there, or at least potentially going on there, that your popular prophecy writers, just put them away. Just put them away. That's probably one of the best pieces of advice I can give you. And if you want some leads, I'm more than happy to give them to you. But the popular stuff, just put it away.
Well, all right. I think you did pretty good on four questions.
Yeah. Well, we had a chance to chit chat, so yeah, that's what it becomes anyway. I like chit chat.
Well, we just want to remind the listeners that our podcast comes out Friday, Saturdays, thereabouts, and the transcripts usually come about 4 to 5 days after. So I'm usually posting the transcripts probably Tuesdays or Wednesdays. So be looking for those on those days if you're interested. Mike, is there anything else you would like to add to this show?
No.
Do you know what we're going to be discussing next week?
Well, we'll jump into Acts 3.
Okay.
And we may do the whole chapter. You know, we'll start speeding up a little bit, just depending on where, you know, I feel like parking, but we may do the whole chapter.
Okay. Well, thanks for listening to another episode of the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.